The Bane Free Radio Hour.
On the podcast, agents of a secret galactic empire ignore peaceniks and visionaries and visit the Leadville, Colorado Safeway to gaze in wonder at the amazing cereal selection. Hardcovers on explosive content, plus we continue the complete audiobook serialization of David Weber's Uncompromising Honor, all right now. Welcome to the Bane Free Radio Hour podcast. It's an honor to have you along. I'm Bane Senior Editor Tony Daniel. Hey, we would be extremely grateful if you would take a bit of time and go over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast and give the Bane Free Radio Hour a 5-star rating. Anything less doesn't help because the rating will bump us up on the algorithms the podcast services use so that others who share your love of great science fiction and fantasy have a better chance to discover this podcast. And if you want to give us any suggestions or comments, you can always email me at podcast@bane.com. Thanks so much for that. This time we have an excellent conversation with Eric Flint and Walter H. Hunt, the authors of the new Ring of Fire novel 1636, The Atlantic Encounter. A pair of Grantville uptimers working for the good guys in Grantville, connected to Mike Stearns, sail to America with a fascinating group of downtime crew on the good ship Challenger, where they encounter Puritans, the Dutch in New Amsterdam, and the contentious, tenacious English in their colony at Jamestown. Along the way, they deploy a secret weapon, a reconnaissance dirigible, to take on the French, who are trying to establish hegemony in America, and try to provide a new destiny for the new world. In case you don't know the premise of the Ring of Fire books, it is that this whole town of West Virginians were flung back in time to continental Germany in the 17th century, where they have to adapt and eventually to thrive. And we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of David Weber's Uncompromising Honor. Now here's the news. Oh ho, we had a really good response to our July ebook sale on all David Drake's RCN novels. So I spoke to the boss and we're going to do it again. And with the most excellent author and series this time. So welcome to the Monsters of August ebook sale. That's right, it's Larry Correa's Monster Hunter International series on sale. Starting on August 3rd and throughout the rest of August, get discounts on all Larry Correa's Monster Hunter International Series ebooks. Save over 28% on Monster Hunter Siege and Monster Hunter Guardian. That's a savings of $2 for each of these ebooks. Plus, save $1 on all of the Monster Hunter International Series, all the other books in the series. Here's the description of Siege. It's D-Day in the City of Monsters when Monster Hunter International Top Hunter Owen Zastava Pitt receives a tip about some hunters who have gone missing in action. He doesn't realize their rescue mission will snowball into the biggest operation in MHI history. It seems their men are being held prisoner in a horrific nightmare dimension, and the only way to reach them is through the radioactive ruins of a monster-infected war zone. It's time for Monster Hunter International to go to war. That's Monster Hunter Siege, which is $2 off on that ebook, and also $2 off on Monster Hunter Guardian by Larry Correa and Sarah Hoyt. Mothers against monsters, monsters lose. While the Monster Hunter International crew are called away on a rescue mission, Julie Shackelford is left behind to hold down the fort and care for her and Owen's newborn son. But when a field call brings her face to face with unspeakable evil, she'll get more excitement than she could have ever hoped for. But this is Julie Shackelford, and the monsters have bitten off more than they can chew in her. So that's $2 off on Monster Hunter Siege and Monster Hunter Guardian ebooks, and $1 off on all the other ebooks in the series. These discounts will be available wherever Bane ebooks are distributed, including Amazon, BNN, Apple Books, and of course, at the Bane ebooks section of the Bane website. Sometimes folks think they can't get ebooks for their Kindles off the Bain ebook site, but you can. And we have that format available. And if you get it from us, you'll have access to the file and you'll really own it. Another bit of a pro tip, the ebook people are going to have to get these prices propagating through the system over the weekend. So the sales prices are very likely to start showing up any point from now until August 3rd. So you really don't have to wait until August 3rd. Check and see if the Monster Hunter Series entry ebook you want is already marked down. The Monsters of August sale. Amazing discounts on all Larry Correa Monster Hunter International Series ebooks. Check it out. This is part one of a two-part interview talking with Eric Flint and Walter H. Hunt about 1636, The Atlantic Encounter. Part two will be available next time on the podcast. Well, I want to welcome Eric Flint and Walter H. Hunt to the podcast, back to the podcast. Hello, guys.
Hi, guys.
It's great to see you this time. We are recording a video version of it. Of course, you might also just be listening out there. We're going to have both versions available as we've been doing. Eric Flint's a modern master of alternate history fiction, and with more than 3 million books in print, he's the creator of the multiple New York Times best-selling Ring of Fire series, starting with 1632. He's written with David Drake, David Weber. I think you're working on a new Honorverse book.
Yeah, I am.
And was for many years a labor union activist and lives outside of Chicago over there on the other side of the line. Walter H. Hunt is the creator of the popular Dark Wings space adventure series which are available at Bain eBooks, by the way. He has nearly 20 years experience in high tech as a software engineer and technical writer. His writing reflects an abiding interest in history. And this is a pretty prime example of what we're going to talk about. Really? His area of college study, which is what he studied, but science fiction has been his favorite reading material since he watched Neil Armstrong walk on the moon when he was but a lad. He is an active Freemason, as shown by the symbology on his shirt. And a lifelong baseball fan. He lives, as shown by all the baseball references in the book, and he lives in Eastern Massachusetts with his wife and daughter.
Daughter's out of town now.
So at Booksellers now is Eric Flint and Walter H. Hunt's novel 1636, The Atlantic Encounter, which is a book in the Ring of Fire series. I guess we could, Walter, you said that this started 10 years ago in Raleigh.
Yep.
What did you mean by that?
Well, on NASFIC, the alternate Worldcon, when Worldcon is out of town, was in Raleigh, and I got my very first event there was a book signing with Eric. So I sat down next to Eric, who had a big long line, and I was there to make him look good. And I said, so I'm interested in 1632, because Chuck Gannon, who I was rooming with, said, you should talk to Eric about 1632. And he said, you know, how about when we get done with this, we go have lunch? And I thought, okay. So we went up and had lunch, and he pitched the idea of doing a 1632 novel set in North America. And I said, sign me up. And so he signed me up. That was 10 years ago.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah, it was 2010.
I knew it was quite a while. I didn't think it was 10 years ago.
And it got written and then fiddled with and then shelved. And then we both went on to other things. And then finally he decided to pull it back out, what, about a year and a half ago?
Yeah.
And so we had to fit it to the timeline that had changed significantly because the timeline moved on. And here it is.
Why did you think that Walter would be the perfect person to write this one with you?
He knew the history. Walter and I have done a book that came out in November, Council of Fire. It's a different series, but it's also Walter really, really knows. There it is. Walter really knows the history of colonial America, which I'm familiar with, but I don't have anything like the depth of knowledge he does. And I knew we needed at some point to kick off, you know, to bring the series into the new world. I was stalling myself because I knew how much research I'd have to do. It's not like I didn't have plenty of other stuff on my plate. And then, you know, I met Walter. Walter and I had actually met prior to this in WindyCon. I remember because that was back when I was editing Jim Bain's Universe magazine. I remember talking to him about possibly him writing stories for that. So I had known him prior to that. But when we had lunch together and when I realized how much Walter knew about that period, I then gave him a really thankless assignment because I really, usually I have a good idea of what the story is going to be. And I, you know, I mean, as a rule with my co-authors, I actually either have already or worked with them to develop a very detailed plot outline, which Walter and I did with Council Fire, for instance. But in this case, I didn't really have much of anything, so I said, I'll tell you what, Walter, just give me a story about an expedition to the New World and, you know, what they discover and, you know.
Yeah, he said, two up-timers, dirigible, New World, go.
Yeah, right.
That's about it.
It really was thankless. So he produced the first draft eventually. There was a problem in the middle part of it needed to be reworked, which is really not Walter's fault. It's the fault of the people who settled there, who are a royal pain in the ass to try to. We're talking about the Puritans, or, you know, the people in Massachusetts.
My ancestors.
God Almighty, they're royal pain in the ass to fit into any the kind of fiction that we write anyway. And so the book was going real good until then. You get that part, and it just kind of, and then it gets out there and it's fine. So what eventually we wound up doing years later is we just cut that all out. And the sort of ship sails in the harbor of Boston and sails out afterward, and what a bunch of bums. And Walter then later took that material and he's reworked it into a novella, which we will be publishing in an upcoming anthology that's set in the New World. But the other thing that happened was that after he'd done the first draft and I read it and thought about it, by then some time had gone by, I don't remember how much, but I realized that as I had done before, that I was really getting ahead of myself in the series and that we really weren't ready yet to go into the New World because there were just too many. I did the same thing when I started writing a project called the Anaconda Project, which eventually got rolled into the Polish Maelstrom, but I put it on ice for, in that case, I think 15 years or close to it, because I just realized, wait a minute, I can't do this. We're not a series as a whole. This isn't ready for it yet. So we took that book, the one that just came out, and put it on a shelf, and then Walter and I went to work on 1636, The Cardinal Virtues, which is the first of two books we're doing on what's happening in France. So that's what we worked on then. And then we eventually went back to, once everything else had moved up far enough, we went back and reworked the Atlantic Encounter into the book that it is now.
And the timeline had shifted considerably since
then. Yeah, a lot of things.
Yeah, we had a lot of changes that we had to make, small things just to make sure that it all fit.
It's writing this complex and long running a series where it presents some challenges, let's just say. you know, keeping everything straight. And sometimes it happens, you just realize this project, we're just going to have to sit on it for a while because we're not ready for it yet.
So where are we in the timeline? And we could talk about the characters as well. We have, you know, to if we need to introduce them, but maybe why are they sending this ship? What the thought is, who the contending parties are, everything we need to know to set this thing up.
Go ahead, Walter.
Want me to go?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Well, We have David Weber to thank for selling all of the British possessions to France in 1633. In fact, in the novel 1633. So the British colonies, which are stretched off along the Atlantic coast, the Atlantic plantations, all technically belong to France. But France has been quite busy from 1633 until 1636, and they haven't really gotten to exploit them. I believe the official designation of the expedition is under the state of Thuringia Franconia, and it's an exploratory mission, diplomatic mission, not a military mission. And it has a dirigible, and it has a radio, so everything's going to be fine, because they can just tell what's going on and say whether the French have decided to send any expeditions to exploit the New World. And of course, you know, we blow up the radio, because wouldn't have been as good a story if we didn't. So Gordon and Peter, who are the uptimers, or brothers, and their downtimer cohorts are kind of left on their own. And they go to the Danish colonies in the Maritimes. Then they go to New England. Then they go to New Amsterdam. And eventually they go to Virginia. They go by way of Maryland, they go to Virginia. And at each step, they have a chance to see exactly what was going on. And we're trying to show how each of the different colonies, and they are very different, how they react to the events of the New World, and how they react to how the Ring of Fire, the arrival of Granville, has changed everything for them. In some cases, not very much. In other cases, quite a lot.
And they're specifically charged with making trouble for the French, right? I mean, if they can.
If they can, yeah. I mean, it's the situation with France is the war is over, the war of the Ostend War, but relations are not good between the United States of Europe and France and Spain also, for that matter. Although the conflicts with Spain are in books I'm writing with Chuck Gannon, and the next one of which is actually coming out in November, 1637, No Peace Beyond the Line.
Yeah, we're not going to be seeing that in this book.
No. This book just takes place before then. The thing that made this book here's the problem I've had as the person who sort of coordinates the whole series, is that a lot of people wanted to write stuff set in the New World, and I've been kind of squelching it for the most part. And the problem is that I knew that there was a big development I wanted to be developing in France that would wind up having a huge impact on the New World, but I wasn't ready to do it yet. So the New World stories that I authorized were ones that were kind of far afield. Ivor Cooper, for instance, has wrote a series of stories set in the Spanish Main, northern South America. And he also had the Japanese colonizing the West Coast. And those were published by Bain a few years ago under the title Seas of Fortune. Stories that were kind of set far away from North America would be okay. But I didn't want people getting too far into what was happening in North America, because I knew I just wasn't ready yet. And part of what Walter and I do in The Atlantic Encounter is, to some degree, that's the novel that will set the basis for a lot of what will now be unfolding in the New World. And the next book that's going to happen there that we're working on is, there's an anthology we're doing that Bain will be publishing. And we don't have a title yet for it, but I just call it the New World Anthology. But it's it will be kicked off by a novella of, actually it's a short novel that I've written with Paula Goodlett-Gorg Huff, that is set in New Amsterdam and depicts what happens in the late 1636 with basically the restoration of the authority of the Netherlands over the New Netherlands in the middle. The New Netherlands, that's the Dutch colony, was not given to the French, so it's still independent. It's all the English colonies that are technically owned by the French. And the French are about to, but this will happen in the anthology. It doesn't happen yet in this novel. The French are about to impose their authority, or at least attempt to, over the New World. Well, we do get into some of it in toward the end of.
They've decided they got to take it seriously if they're going to impose their authority.
Yeah, yeah, right. So it's been complicated to make it work, and that's why there was this long delay in publishing a book, because we just weren't ready for it.
Yeah. So this ship takes off, and it has on it a guy that really likes balloons. And he liked him before he got sent back in time. And it's got a balloon. It's got a dirigible on it. Tell us about the Challenger and Gordon and what's up with that?
Well, Gordon went to the balloon festival when he took off from Grantville and wandered about without his kid brother, who was a sort of a juvenile delinquent with a good pitching arm. So the summer before the Ring of Fire, he's off sort of hitchhiking the country, and he winds up in Albuquerque and visits the balloon festival and sort of falls in love with ballooning, which is not hard to imagine. It's something I'd love to do myself. His brother doesn't get to come along with him, and the plan was that they were going to go back the summer of 2000, and then suddenly they get as he said, we get a German vacation instead. Challengers, I can't tell you too much about the ship itself. It's Uptimer in the sense that it has a wheel instead of
it's a got a wheel so that you could have Tom Kidd paint a wheel, right?
Right. Well, that's on the dirigible.
That's on the dirigible.
Oh, it's on the dirigible.
Right. There's actually a ship's wheel on the ship, which is out of character for the century, where they used a whipstaff, where you actually. The captain says it makes perfect sense. You move it to the left if you want to go right, and you move it to the right if you want to go left. All this turning the wheel in the same direction that the ship is going. I mean, who does that? But the dirigible is, from Pete's perspective, from the younger brother's perspective, the dirigible is something we can use to scare the natives. And from Gordon's perspective, it's, no, they'll shoot flaming arrows at us. We have to be careful. It's the only dirigible we have, and if it goes down, we don't have it anymore. And so it's used judiciously and tactically. But this is, in some ways, it's Gordon and Peter having a chance to get together as brothers. And they're very different. Gordon's a save the whales guy. He said save the Indians. He doesn't want them to be massacred. He doesn't want the Pequots to be massacred. He doesn't understand why we can't change the future by acting better in the past. And Pete is acclimated to the 17th century. He's settled there. He's comfortable there. Who are the wrecking crew guys? Harry
Lefferts.
He's like a Lefferty. Completely comfortable.
Well, he really gets along just fine in the 17th century. Although even Harry has a late 20th century sensibility about all kinds of things. Part of what happens in the whole series is you have these uptimers who do carry modern ideologies and views of history and what they think of American history, and they'd like to see things be done better. And not all of them, but most of them do, and they try. And to some degree, they succeed. In some cases, they succeed quite spectacularly. But there's also, first of all, there's unforeseen consequences. And then secondly, there's, some things take time. I mean, there's no way around it. You're not going to make any quick changes. And the issue in the New World is really, really thorny. It's interesting because the whole issue has flared up again in recent times over, how to look at the old world colonizing the new world. And what makes it so difficult, and we're trying to get some of this across, at least in the book, is that to some degree this is inevitable. I mean, you've got two continents or two hemispheres, one of which, for a whole variety of reasons, is much more populous and more developed technologically in all kinds of other ways that arrives in the New World, and there's going to be a huge impact on that society. Years ago, Steve Saffel was at that time an editor at Delray Books asked me if I could write an alternate history where the Trail of Tears never happened. And I said, yeah, if you let me start in the time of the Vikings. And he said, no, I want something, you know, that takes place in the early 19th century. And I said, Steve, I can't do it, because by the time you get to 1820, the demographic imbalance is so enormous that there's no way that Indians in the South are not going to get displaced. I mean, there's just no realistic way you can depict it not happening.
There are ways it could have come out differently. Yes, the ways it could have come out differently, but ultimately, the natives have to leave Mississippi.
Right. Well, one way, what I did was propose a different way of dealing, which he liked, and that eventually became the novel 1812, The Rivers War, followed by 1824, The Arkansas War. And Bain will be publishing the sequel to that, and the rights are reverted back, so Bain will eventually be reissuing those books. In fact, that will be the next book I start on after I finish the Honorverse book. With David Weber. But it's really difficult because, you know, it's intractable. There's no quick, easy solutions to any of these problems. And that's part of what we tried, Walter and I tried to convey in the book, is that, yeah, a lot of stuff, really cruddy stuff was done. And a lot of that can be prevented or at least forestalled. But a lot of it, you know, it's going to be murky.
And there are three places where we point that out.
Yeah.
Gordon and Peter are present to help head off what would have led to the Pequot War. And we don't know whether it'll still happen, but it won't happen quite the same way.
Right.
The Dutch captain shows them Zwanendael, the failed Swedish colony, which is destroyed by Indians not long before the time of the novel. And then they're facing what's happening in Virginia. And not too long after the time of the novel, there's an enormous Indian massacre that takes place in Virginia. And we don't know if the presence of uptimers or the French is going to change how that comes in, because they thought they trusted the Powhatans. And of course they betrayed them and killed a third of the Virginians in 1644, which is not very far away. So we're pointing out the ways in which any of that could happen. But one of the things is that Gordon and Peter have completely different views on this. Gordon feels like the white people were the problem. They failed to do what they should have done, and they should have been nicer, and they should have been better, and they should have been more conscientious. And Gordon and the Downhammers say, you know, they're fundamentally different people, and we shouldn't be catering to them, because we're here now. This is our land now. What do they expect? This is how it works. Survival of the fittest, all that stuff. So
where do they go first? They go to Canada and work their way down the coast, right?
Yeah, essentially north to south. They start with visiting the Danish colonies in what's now Newfoundland and that area. And those are based on stories that have been written by Herb Sacklaus. There have been two that have been published by Ring of Fire Press. One of them is The Danish Scheme, and the sequel is called The Battle from Newfoundland. So we start there and mesh with those stories. Then they start moving south, and they go past. I mean, they don't stop in French Canada because they're not on. But they head into Boston, and that doesn't go real well, dealing with the Puritans and the Pilgrims. So then they go down to New Amsterdam, and then from there they keep going south, and they eventually wind up in Virginia, which is where the novel ends with. There is a French expedition coming, and there's what you see on the cover is.
Well, let's talk about some of the historical figures they meet, like Champlain. That was right. Cool.
Yeah, I did a short story about Champlain in Ring of Fire 3, which was based on the idea that the butterfly effect works both ways. Champlain returns to the New World in the fall of 1635, knowing that the uptime history says he's going to have a stroke. and die just before Christmas. And then it doesn't happen. But some downtimer gets the news that he's had this stroke because it's in the history. And they assume that's a proper time to try and attack the whites. Of course, he's there waiting for them. So Champlain's already been introduced. But he's an interesting figure. I did a lot of reading about Champlain, and he's fascinating. Richelieu does not like him at all, but he has staying power. He is the most significant figure in New France prior to the 17th century, right, the 18th century. Well, he's the biggest 17th century figure there is. And I like him a lot, but the court doesn't.
So, what's going on in Canada? There's mining, right? That's what the Dutch.
No, that's the Danes.
Danes are doing some mining. The big thing in North
Canada is a big empty place.
Huh?
Canada is a big empty place. It's furs and
furs, yeah. In fact, it
was even captured by the English for a short time, not long before the setting of the novel. French just got it back. But they first settled there about 25 years before the novel. But New France is a huge empty place filled with natives and bateaux and furs and not much else.
And it might be a good time now to talk about some of the other characters on the ship, like Ingrid Ingrid is the doctor, and our little spy who sneaks aboard.
Stefan Hoff, yes.
And who becomes a major character in the book, and he meets more Native Americans than any of the other characters also, and kind of has to deal with the possibility of getting killed in horrific ways.
He starts off as someone who's basically a combination of street waif and street criminal, in a gang in Paris. He comes from Alsace, and then the French police break up the gang, and he gets captured. He eventually becomes an agent for the French government, indirectly for Richelieu. He doesn't report directly to Richelieu, and then he winds up. He's assigned a spy on the Americans, see what the hell they're doing with this expedition of some kind they seem to be organizing. And he winds up on the ship by accident, sort of. And then the ship sails off and he's on it. So it's like, okay. So that's how he winds up in the New World. And then the problem is he's out of touch with his employers back in France. And he has his own set of adventures, and he doesn't realize how big North America is. So he jumps ship, and then he said, "Well, I'll go to Quebec." And it doesn't really dawn on him. That's not a short hike, buddy. You know, you're talking hundreds of miles through wilderness. And
that reflects how the old worlders thought of the New World. They didn't. They simply had no conception of how big it was. Whether it's Virginia or New France, it's just huge. Yeah. Distances are very, very long.
Europeans are still like that.
Oh yeah, no. Oh, yeah. They were friends of a friend of mine years ago, and I'm visiting him in New York, and this French couple arrived, and they're very nice people. We're talking to them, and they said they weren't going to make a hop over from New York to Chicago, and we said, you are aware that distance is about as far as from Paris to Warsaw. I forgot what it is, but it's about 1,000 miles, you know, which that had not dawned on them, or it just hadn't registered. Just quite. It's a different scale if you're used to. No place in Britain is more than 80 miles from the coast, for instance. I mean, it's a different scale altogether. And this was 400 years, well, not quite 400 years, but close to it. And so, yeah, people, especially some street kid from Alsace, I mean, he has no, it's not like he was some expert on the geography of any place except Paris. And here he is alone and cast adrift, so to speak, in the New World. And he has his own set of adventures. He's a lot of fun to work with.
He was my favorite character in the whole book.
He's a delightful character. And he's a plucky kid, you know. And he winds up having his own set of adventures, and by the end of the book, stuff happens. Which I'm not going to. He added a lot to the book. Walter came up with him. He added a lot to the book. He's a lot of fun.
You didn't like him at first, but he warmed to him.
Huh?
I said you didn't like him at first.
That's not true.
Well, he's fun because he's got a certain humility about him. He doesn't think immediately he can handle everything, and he's also really smart. So he's fun to identify with as an underdog character,
and very resourceful.
Yeah. And what about your proto-feminist doctor, Ingrid
Skoglund
from Norway or Sweden?
She's Swedish. Yeah.
She's trained in Grantville in modern medicine. By the time she gets on this boat.
Yep.
Walter, you want to? Or do you want me?
Well, we decided the one thing we didn't want to do was send her in there as a stock love interest. We wanted her to be a professional that pulled her own weight, and she does so. I mean, she has this great scene in Virginia where she wants to find out what's going on with the. With Stefan, who they've tracked down. And she goes in and essentially suggests to him that she's going to do a surgical operation on him right then and there if he doesn't tell the truth. So she can be very ruthless. And I loved writing that scene. But we wanted her to be a real solid character who stood on her own. And that meant she had to have a Grantville background in order to do that.
Yeah, one dramatic problem we face with this book, just because of it's just inherent in the plot with us. Basically, it's a sea voyage, and you know, it was like, well, we don't want an all male cast of characters, which is sort of intrinsically how something like that's going to tend to shape up. So we did want some female characters in it, and one, there are two. One of them is Ingrid. She's the main one, but there's also a character of a French indentured servant who figures a bit later in the book and winds up, well, I don't want to get in too far into the plot, but she becomes an important figure in it also.
But she's a skilled craftsman as well. She is too.
Her problem is that she is a skilled craftsman, and she becomes an indentured servant expecting a certain thing when she arrives, and then discovers that the bottom's fallen out, and there she's stuck. And, you know, she's a young single woman and doesn't have much in the way of resources, so she's also got to figure out how she's going to make her way. And luckily for her, she winds up becoming friends with Stefan, the Alsatian guy, and between the two of them, they manage to work out stuff. But one of the things Walter and I wanted to avoid in the book was just having these things just be sort of stock romantic relationships. We didn't want that. So they're not, I mean, there may be at some later, but right now that's not what's going on. And it just makes for a different kind of story. Challenge always when you write historical fiction or fiction set in a historical period, which is that, you know, you can't stray too far from the reality of what that historical period would have been like, or else it just becomes, you know, fantasy. But that can create dramatic restrictions of promise where you got to figure out a way to get around them. So
you did the same thing with Anne of Austria in the Cardinal Virtues book.
Yeah.
We had to transform her from there's lots of literature written about Anne of Austria, of King Louis XIII's wife, from being a very weak, not very bright woman to being this sort of dominant personality. So we wanted to make her somebody who had to react to an unusual situation and stand on her own, and she does. She has to have lots of help, but she's a very strong character in that book, and we endeavor to try and do the same thing with her.
We face a similar problem again with Castle of Fire, which I was very happy with how we
right
I agree. Two major female characters in that, one of whom is European, the other is African-American. And they're very different, but they're both really fun to work with. And they're major characters in the story. But you'd have to work at it some, because there's, you know, it was one of the things Griff Barber and I had to do with the books we're doing on Mughal India, because our heroine, Jahanara, who's the princess, I mean, she's restricted most of her life in the harem, you know, which did not prevent these women from being very, very powerful. But it's, you have to be able to do that dramatically and show how it actually works out. I thought we did a really good job of that. Anyway, that was where Ingrid originated from. We looked at it and said, well, wait a minute, we need to get a,
we need a female character.
We need to get at least one female character.
Yeah. Well, she's cool. And she does capitalize on their fear of plague and disease, which thank God we've gotten over now.
Oh yeah, I mean we still don't worry about that.
Yeah, you know, we have upcoming September. We're doing annually. We always do a Ring of Fire convention. But in times past, we've always piggybacked off another convention, so that, you know, basically they provide the infrastructure and we bring in more people for them. This year it was going to be NASFIC, and we are still participating in NASFIC. They're having a virtual thing, but we're going to do our own virtual con. And one of the panels we're going to do is pandemics then and now, because it's not as if social distancing was just invented. And they were very rigorous about it. If you go back a few hundred years, you got quarantined, you damn well stayed in your house. No fooling. Anyway, yeah.
That was part one of a two-part interview talking with Eric Flint and Walter H. Hunt about 1636, The Atlantic Encounter. Part two will be available next time on the podcast. Here is another entry in David Weber's Honor Harrington series masterpiece, Uncompromising Honor. Honor keeps her promise. The Solarian League. For hundreds of years, they have borne the banner of human civilization. But the bureaucratic mandarins who rule today's league are corrupt and looking for scapegoats. They've decided the upstart Star Kingdom of Manticore must be annihilated. Uncompromising courage. Honor Harrington has worn the Star Kingdom's uniform for half a century. Very few know war the way Honor Harrington does. So far, hers has been a voice of caution. But now the Mandarins have committed atrocities such as the galaxy has not known in 1,000 years. They have finally killed too many of the people Honor Harrington loves. Uncompromising vengeance. Now Honor Harrington is coming for the Solarian League, and hell is riding in her wake. And now, David Weber's Uncompromising Honor.
Point defense engaging now! Wozniak snapped as the attack missiles swept through the squadron's formation and the laser clusters went to maximum rate fire. Rods of coherent energy stabbed out, matching the speed of cybernetic reflexes against the attacker's incredible velocity as the cataphracts cleared the shadow of their target's impeller wedges. Missiles, unlike starships, couldn't generate sidewalls. That meant they could be taken down by laser fire even before they dropped their wedges, if the geometry was right. The geometry was right for quite a few of the Solarian missiles, and the waiting lasers punched straight through them. Many of their fellows simply streaked across the vulnerable sides of the cruiser's wedges without ever finding a target in the fleeting moments their preposterous velocity gave their sensors. Others were more fortunate in that regard, and missile wedges vanished and laser heads rolled on incredibly powerful thrusters as they fought to align their lasing rods with their targets, but the point defense was waiting for them. Jane Isatalo watched the display. At 36 million kilometers, the light-speed lag was just over 2 minutes. Impeller signatures were FTL, so tracking could plot her missile's inbound positions in near real time. There was still a 1.89-second delay, but her sensors would need the full 2 minutes to detect anything else, including nuclear detonations. Because of that, she couldn't really see a thing once the missile's impellers went down, and she waited impatiently, along with everyone else on Fujoyant's flag deck, for the telltale flare of detonating laser heads. Manticore's electronically steered laser cluster cycled much more rapidly than the SLNs did. It was, Sir Martin Lessam reflected, a prime example of those Darwinian processes that worried him where the Sollies were concerned. The increasing deadliness of the missile environment in Manticore's long war with the People's Republic of Haven had given the Royal Manticore Navy's R&D people no choice but to improve cycle time. In fact, Klaus Fleming's cycle time was almost 50% more rapid than that of an earlier flight Saganami C, and each of her clusters mounted not the 8 emitters of an early flight ship, but 12, almost twice as many as a Nevada-class battlecruiser's clusters. Cycle time didn't matter all that much this time. The window of engagement was so brief that not even a Manticoran emitter could have fired 2 shots in the available time. On the other hand, each of Klaus Fleming's broadsides mounted 24 point defense clusters with 12 emitters each. That was 288 shots from each broadside, 576 in total, with the same from each of his other 3 Saganami Cs, and an additional 288 from each of his 6 Saganami Bs, with fewer emitters per cluster, but more total clusters per ship. In all, including his destroyers, his squadron mounted over 3,000 emitters, already coached into waiting positions by the Ghost Rider tracking reports. The tension on Klaus Fleming's bridge could have been chipped with a knife, because no one knew better than Manticorans that any ship could be killed, however good its defenses, however skilled its crew. But this was a deadly ballet the Royal Manticoran Navy had danced countless times in the last 20 years. Its officers and ratings knew its measures better than anyone else in the galaxy, and the space around Sir Martin Lessam's squadron was suddenly a tornado of disintegrating cataphracts as the defenses picked them off with viper speed and metronome precision. Shattered missile bodies tumbled onward into the endless dark, broken and inert. But even in the midst of their destruction, scores of surviving laser heads disappeared in bubbles of intolerable brilliance, and bomb-pumped X-ray lasers stabbed out at Kruron 912. They must have had even better tracks on the incoming fire than she'd thought from their countermissiles, Isatala realized, as impeller signatures began vanishing too early for end-of-run detonations. Thanks to the light-speed delay, she had ample time to contemplate the implications of those premature disappearances, and she didn't like them one bit. Her salvo hadn't melted like a sandcastle, because there hadn't been enough time for that. One heartbeat it had been streaking towards its target, the next, the Manti Point defense had ripped it to shreds. She'd never seen anything like it, never imagined mere cruisers could produce that volume of defensive fire. Yet not even that fire could have stopped all of them. There literally weren't enough places on ships that size to put enough laser clusters to take out that many threats. Dozens, scores of them must have gotten through unscathed. Unfortunately, she knew, the defenders had concentrated on the ones that could have hurt them, and most of those surviving dozens and scores would have wasted themselves against their targets' wedges and sidewalls. But the missiles crossing ahead of the Mantis would be another matter. A ship simply couldn't pack as many laser clusters into her fore and aft hammerheads, and it was obvious from the timing that a higher percentage of missiles attacking the throats of the Manticoran wedges had shut down their impellers rather than being picked off on the way in. By rights, most of the birds who'd reached shutdown positions should have gotten their lasers off before they could be destroyed, and the throat of a starship's impeller wedge was far deeper than its sidewalls. That made it a much, much bigger target. 73 laser heads detonated directly ahead of HMS Klaus Fleming, and 730 bomb-pumped lasers ripped down the throat of her wedge. But unlike the Salarian Navy's warships, the throats of current-generation Manticoran warships were no longer the traditional gaping chink in their armor. The bow wall and its smaller cousin, the buckler, had finally provided the equivalent of a sidewall, and a very powerful sidewall, to cover that lethally vulnerable aspect of the wedge. That was one reason Sir Martin Lessam had waited motionless in space. He couldn't accelerate with the full bow wall up, and he didn't trust the smaller buckler to provide sufficient cover. But he also hadn't wanted to suddenly stop accelerating at the instant the wall went up, lest the Sollies figure out that something was covering that aspect of Manticoran ships. The laser heads detonating in front of Klaus Fleming were never able to properly localize their target, because they simply couldn't see it clearly enough through the bow wall's focused gravitic plane. All they could do was fire blindly, trying to saturate the entire volume in which the heavy cruiser might be located. That was an awfully wide volume for even 700 lasers to cover, and the bow wall bent and degraded even those which had managed to find a target in the first place. Admiral Isatalo reminded herself to breathe as she waited for the laggard photons to tell her how many of her missiles had survived to attack and how well they'd fared. The human eye was notoriously unreliable at moments like this, but CIC's uncaring, hyper-efficient computers count had already confirmed that the Mantis had picked off at least 75% of her total launch before the surviving missiles dropped their wedges to attack. That was yet another conclusion she didn't much like, and she made a mental note to grab those over-optimistic idiots in the Office of Technical Analysis by their throats and choke some sense into them as soon as she got back to Sol. They had to start coming closer to realistic assessments, or the Mantis were going to go right on kicking the Navy's arse. She had the numbers to punch out a force this small, despite the flawed enemy capability estimates with which she'd been sent out. But somebody else was going to run into a proper Manti task force, and when they did... The thought broke off, and her lips drew back in a snarl of satisfaction, as the light-speed sensors finally updated the plot and hundreds of laser heads erupted in bubbles of nuclear fusion. Even as she snarled, she knew her most pessimistic estimate of how many had gotten through had been overly optimistic. But her targets were only cruisers, and at least 50 or 60 laser heads detonated directly ahead of four of them. They sent the deadly stilettos of their bomb-pumped lasers straight down the wide-open throats of their victims' wedges. And absolutely nothing happened. "We took one hit forward, sir," Commander Wozniak told Lessem. "Grazer 1's gone, and so is Point Defense 4. 7 casualties, non-fatal." He looked back down at his display. "Robert L. Gartner reports one hit starboard, frame 7-5. That one cost 2 counter-missile launchers, but Captain Reicher thinks he can get one of them back and reports no personnel casualties. Michael Cucciarelli took 2 hits, but she was lucky. Captain Dissol's lost both of his secondary grav sensor arrays, but he reports no personnel casualties or weapon systems damage. Edward Dravecki took 2 hits, 1 down her throat and 1 port side, frame 200. The hit forward knocked out a beta node, and the power surge killed 2 ratings in her forward impeller room. The port side hit destroyed Grazer 8 and countermissile 37. 9 casualties there. 2 fatal, I'm afraid." Lessem nodded heavily, his expression tight. 4 hits and 18 casualties, only 4 of them fatal, was a minuscule return for 6,000 pod-launched missiles. He knew that, and knowing did absolutely nothing to make it hurt less, because those 18 casualties were his people. "On the other hand," he thought grimly, "I have to wonder how the other side's reacting to this." Isatalo heard Bartholu Rosiak inhale sharply, swallowing what probably would have been a curse, as the same shock lashed through the operations officer. There should have been some sign of damage, she thought, almost numbly. They just fired over 800 cataphracts right down the Mantis' throats, each with the warhead of a Trebuchet Capital missile, and CIC confirmed that at least a quarter of them, more probably a third of the crossing shots, had detonated before interception. Call it 230 to split the difference, and that was still 2,300 lasers against perfect targets. Hit probabilities at that insane crossing speed against a target which couldn't even be seen clearly until the attack missile sensors cleared that target's wedge and could look down its throat had to be tiny, despite the ideal geometry of any crossing-the-T attack. She and Rosiak had estimated no more than a 1% hit ratio in such circumstances, rather than the 38% ratio they would have expected at a pre-cataphract crossing rate. But that was still 23 hits. That might not inflict crippling damage, scattered across 10 ships the size of Manti cruisers, but it damned well should have inflicted some, and the Manti's emissions hadn't even flickered. "I see we're going to need heavier salvos," Admiral Jane Isatalo said coldly. "What do you expect them to try next, sir?" Commander Turi asked quietly. Commodore Lessem glanced at him, then returned his gaze to the tactical plot. He stood that way for several moments, hands clasped behind him, whistling soundlessly.
"The one thing I don't expect him to do is to try another long-range launch, unless he's able to put a hell of a lot more missiles into it," he said then. "We didn't expect their new accelerations, and their projected accuracy was better than we expected at that range, too," he acknowledged with a shrug. "But not enough better to offset our advantages in missile defense, And judging from their attack profile, they don't know about the bow wall either. But unless they're idiots, and frankly, whoever this fellow is, he doesn't strike me as another Crandall or Filaretta, he'd have figured out that something sure as hell knocked back the damage all those down-the-throat shots should have inflicted. He turned away from the plot, pacing slowly across the flag bridge to his command chair. He sank into the chair and turned it to face the astrogation plot while the chair's displays deployed around him. "He'll want to get closer," he said then, his eyes narrowing. "If we can take all those down-the-throat shots without showing more damage than we did, he needs every scrap of accuracy he can get. That means getting into effective telemetry range, his effective telemetry range. And out here, he just might pull that off." The chief of staff nodded, his expression thoughtful, then smiled. "In that case, sir, it's probably a good thing that you're, and I say this with the utmost respect, a sneaky bastard."
"I'll take that as a compliment, Commander," Sir Martin Lessem replied with an answering smile.
That was another entry in the complete audiobook serialization of Uncompromising Honor by David Weber. That's it for the podcast. Thanks to Audible.com and to podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And a giant Mobius strip Klein's Bottle Intersection time machine from the Egyptian era, made only by grass-fed organic volunteers from neighboring tribes, very likely little, if any, slave labor. Plus thanks, praise, and gratitude to Eric Flint and Walter H. Hunt, authors of 1636, The Atlantic Encounter. Please join us next time here at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy. Keep reaching for the stars.